Hey guys, it's Chelsea, and I am doing something really exciting for the holidays this year. On December 7th, I'll be hosting one of my all-time most requested workshops called The Art of Entertaining. It's going to be a two-hour live workshop with everything you need to become an all-time amazing host, whether it's dinner parties, cocktail or mocktail parties, overnight guests, holiday parties, whatever you're looking to throw, we'll talk about how to do it at any budget. You can join us live, or you can watch the recording later at any time, and it is totally free. This event is just exclusive to members of our society at TFD, and we will be hosting regular members-only events to celebrate with our beloved members. If you're already a member of the society at TFD, you don't need to do anything. You'll get access sent to you. If you're not, simply join at the link in our description, either on YouTube or on Patreon, wherever you prefer to join your membership clubs. Either way, on top of all of our amazing Society at TFD perks, now you're getting regular events, starting with the Art of Entertaining. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to an all-new episode of The Financial Confessions. It's me, your host, Chelsea Fagan, founder and CEO of The Financial Diet and woman who loves to talk about money. And today I want to talk about one of the most highly requested topics on this channel, which is building wealth in an ethical way. Often a lot of the advice that we hear around achieving financial freedom and building wealth for ourselves can come at the cost of the communities that we live in and can make the situation around us worse. And as you know, as we often talk about here at TFD, there is really no self without the community. We are all part of a tapestry. I mean, you walk out of your house, you walk on a sidewalk, you get in your car, you go into another building that's safe and up to code and isn't falling apart and that doesn't have like electrical wires in the water system. All of that was government. All of that was community. All of that is the place that you are a part of. That being said, for many of us, especially those of us who come from, for example, lower income backgrounds, immigrant backgrounds, complicated backgrounds, there are few avenues to building long-term wealth that don't involve some compromises. At the end of the day, as we all know, the easiest way to get rich in America is to be born rich. But for those of us who don't necessarily come from those advantages, we have to find other ways. So a lot of the questions that you all ask are some version of, well, what are ways to build wealth that don't necessarily come at the cost of my community or can actually be beneficial to those around me? The person I'm speaking to today about all of that and more is someone who is really uniquely positioned to speak on these issues and who also happens to have a brand new book coming out in just a few weeks, which will be linked. She is the host, many of you may know her, of the Journey to Launch podcast, Jamila Souffrant.
Hi.
Hi, Jamila, how are you?
I'm so excited to be here.
I'm so excited to have you and so excited for this book. Let's start off by plugging it. Yes. What is it?
It's called Your Journey to Financial Freedom, a step-by-step guide to achieving wealth and happiness. And it'll be out December 5th, but it really is a culmination. I call it my financial and life love letter to my existing audience, so my journeyers. I call people on this path with me the financial independence journeyers, but also hopefully to new journeyers who want to learn more about how, which I love your intro just now, how, you know, the average person can achieve wealth and happiness. And you're not born into money, you don't necessarily marry into money, you don't win the lottery, but how do you do it in a way where it's sustainable and you feel good about yourself and your life? And so that's what I talk about in the book, how to break down the journey to financial independence, which is a very privileged and audacious goal to want to achieve to in a way that makes it feel achievable for people.
I love that. So let's start by just kind of establishing your particular journey, because as we talked about before we turned on the cameras, so you are in many ways indicative of two different versions of New York, right? You came here as an immigrant and are now living in Brooklyn, a mother of three. So a very kind of typical New Yorker. But on the other hand, you've worked in asset management. You have built all this personal wealth. You have, you know, your own media brand. So can you talk a little bit about your life and your journey to get here and kind of those two versions of yourself?
Yes. Well, so I was born on the beautiful island of Jamaica, and my mom was young. She was 20 years old when she had me, and she was a single mom. So my dad wasn't around. I knew who he was. I knew his family, but he didn't provide for me. But she had the opportunity to come to the States. Her father filed for her, and just her, because he didn't know about me. So he came to, and her father wasn't really in her life. So he came to give her the papers when they came in. And then he saw me and he was just like, who is this baby? I only have papers for you. So you need to make a decision. And she only gave her like, in the book, I think it's like a week or so to make a choice to either stay with me or to leave to then go to the States. And so she chose to leave, which I can't imagine how hard that was being a mom, but I also can't imagine it because she was so fueled to start a new life or pathway for herself and for me. And so that meant risking everything. So she came here on her own. You know, there was no internet. She had to use the Yellow Pages for resources, had to go on government assistance, worked very low-end jobs to finally be able to bring me over eventually with my grandmother. And
how long was that? Sorry.
So I came up here when I was just under 2 years old. She left me at 8 months.
Okay.
So it was quite a bit of time, but any money she saved or she worked, she sent back to help take care of me. And she knew education was going to be the pathway for her to get somewhere here. And so she got her associates and eventually her bachelor's and then her master's in social work. And with that, you know, I was very much involved or like her sidekick growing up because she couldn't really afford childcare. Mm-hmm. And with that, I just watched her work. I saw my grandmother work really hard. So like most immigrants and older women, she didn't have her degree. So she ended up watching wealthy people's kids as, you know, a living as a nanny. And she would come home and tell my mom, you know, they have me reading every night to like these kids. And so my mom, being the amazing person she is, even though she didn't have that growing up, said, well, if the wealthy people are doing this, then I'm going to make sure I read to Jamila every night and take her to the library. And so we didn't have a lot of money, but she really instilled in me the importance of education and exploring my own talents and giving me a lot of, I'd say, motivation and confidence. So that just carried with me as I grew up. And we didn't, again, have much, but I just saw how hard she worked to put herself in a better position, which definitely left the imprint on me growing up. And eventually I saw my grandmother buy a home in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, a 3-family brownstone before it was even, you know, what it is now. And that left the imprint on me because I kept seeing like these amazing feats that the women in my life were accomplishing. And so at the age of, I would say when I got into college, I was interested in real estate. I loved it because I remember meeting, I used to go swimming at the Y, or my little sister went swimming at the Y. And we met a grandmother who owned brownstones, and she didn't look wealthy, you know, this older black woman, but she owned like 6 brownstones. And she just talked about how, you know, that is her legacy, that's her wealth. And then I met someone else who was the same way. And I was like, I want to be able to own real estate. And so at a very young age, I got interested in wanting to own something. And so when I got to college, that was my goal. Like, I want to buy a brownstone before I graduate or upon graduation. And in that time, brownstones, I mean, they were cheaper, obviously, than they are now, but I couldn't afford that as a college student. And so eventually I lucked up on finding pre-construction condominiums in a place called Dumbo, down under the Manhattan Bridge overpass. And I didn't know what really that area, even though I didn't grow up too far from there, because eventually my grandmother ended up buying something not too far. But I said to myself, well, I can't afford the 3-family brownstones I really want, but I can afford maybe, barely, the cheapest studio apartment in this new high-rise building that they're building. And there was nothing in Dumbo. That was one of the first buildings.
What year was this?
This was, so I ended up closing, I'd have to, all the dates are kind of rummaging through, but I graduated college in 2007. So I signed on pre-construction, I signed it in 2007 before I graduated, and it took 2 years to complete.
Okay, so the place actually existed in 2009.
Yes, yeah, so, but I used to drive by it every day on my way to work when I worked full-time. To like see it literally be built brick by brick as I was driving to work, and I was living at home and saving up for the additional money. So I put down 10% to save the apartment. My mom helped me with that, which is so interesting when I hear, you know, people, if you like say the full story, people are like, oh yeah, your mom helped you. And it's like, yeah, she did. And I like to say that and be upfront with that because she didn't own anything at that point. She barely, you know, she just ended up buying something for herself. But the fact that she saved her money to help me buy something, like, I think is a feat coming from where she came from. And so I saved the rest of the 10% and the closing costs over the next couple of years while it was being built. and I was able to move into this condo. And it was really at the time of the bubble. So on paper, I could not afford this condo because my income was barely covering the mortgage. But because of no loan document mortgages at the time. So even though a lot of people got burned that way and being able to get mortgages they couldn't afford, I was one of those people where it worked in my favor because by the time I did close on the unit and it was built, it was worth more than my contract. And so I thought to myself, worst case, I sell it. But I was able to move in because I was saving money from my job. And so that is the beginning part of my journey, like me really making a bold move, a risky move at that, to own something in Brooklyn. But it was inspired by seeing my grandmother and all what I call these undercover millionaires or people who were just looked average that had this wealth, but it was very, it's just very stealth. And I that's what I wanted for myself too.
So you bought this piece of property that was at the time in a no-name neighborhood. And now, for those who don't know, who don't live in New York, Dumbo is one of the most expensive neighborhoods in all of New York City. And you've since sold that
No, I
property.
still
Oh,
own
you
it.
still
So
own
I
it.
still own it and rent it out. And it's so interesting because it's been the riskiest but best investment I've made. And so I've been renting it out. So I lived in there a few years. And then when I got engaged, my husband and I, we moved in to like his parents' basement to save money for the wedding. But I rented it out since. And I've been asked by neighbors one time to buy me out so they can like expand the apartment that was next door. And, I got a couple emails, but for me right now, I couldn't sell and get back into that building. So it's financially, it would be probably smart like to do it, but for me, it's more of an emotional attachment. I envision it's not too many people that look like me who own in the building, and I envision my kids one day if they decide to stay in the city. I mean, they might have to fight about it, who's staying with, and like get a bunk bed or something, but that could be a place that they can stay. Or my husband and I, if we downsize from our home now, maybe we'll live in the studio. So I still own it.
So, per my intro and kind of the question that we get all the time, so there's, especially in cities like New York that are facing huge housing crises, right? Where people don't there aren't enough affordable ho there isn't enough affordable housing stock. There's not nearly enough constraints around what can be charged, especially post-pandemic. People are seeing their rents jump by hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars. A lot of people ask the question, is it even possible to be an ethical landlord, especially in cities like this? And coming from the background you did, as you mentioned, your mom, when she helped you, she didn't even herself own property at that time. So you come from a pretty unique perspective in that respect, and are also, as you mentioned, a pretty rare case in the building that you're technically a landlord in. So can you talk a little bit about your view of being an ethical landlord, if that's possible, and what it looks like in sort of the greater context of New York?
Yeah. I think in general, even participating in the system, this capitalist system and all with all its flaws, like it's hard to, be a pure or true to keeping your hands clean because you're participating, you're helping move the system along with your money. And so I think it's a realization that I've accepted, but then doesn't mean you get dirty or do things ultimately that are not right. Like you do your best with the tools you have. And so the options for a lot of people are to one, they might not even be able to come play in the sandbox at all. Like they have to stand on the sidelines. And then if you're able to get in the sandbox like I am, like okay, even though other people are playing dirty, how do you try to be the one that plays clean? Even though you're in the sandbox, which is still a privileged position, so I just feel like just being honest with like that, it's there is a contrast and contradictions in that. But for me personally, it is connecting with my tenants that I've had over the years, being fair. I can probably charge a lot more for my rent. My tenant now, she's amazing. And I think she appreciates that, she for a couple times she asked for some extension because she's trying to figure out what she wants to do. And I'm just like, yes, because I'd rather have a great tenant than just have more money. And so for me, I think it's a choice that you have to consciously make, and you have to decide. And I think this is a decision that comes with money a lot is, is it worth it? Is it worth having and squeezing that extra dollar and the people that you need to squeeze to do that to make more? Or do you, for me, want to live in harmony and have just a clear conscience as much as I can participating in, you know, this economy and in the system?
And in your property that you actually live in, do you own that or you rent it?
We own it. Okay. So my husband and I own that one together. And we actually ended up, so when we did that, when I bought my condo, it was right at the perfect time. So when I closed on it, it had gained and appreciated in value. We did that again. Well, my husband and I wanted to buy a place in downtown Brooklyn, and we ended up buying something. But we signed the contract right before like the market crash. And with that, the value of our unit went down. So the opposite happened. So while my first real estate transaction went really well, I saw what happened when it doesn't work well. When you sign something pre-construction and then, you know, a week or 2 weeks later, the price is worth less than you're in contract for. So we ended up doing that and following through with that contract, but then selling it after a couple of years.
Got it. Okay. So, you know, you mentioned that when you were living in, not in Dumbo, but nearby, it was a fairly low income area. Is that fair to say, or at least kind of nothing special?
Well, I grew up in different parts of Brooklyn.
Okay.
And so I've, you know, grew up in Brownsville, which is like a pretty rougher area than where we eventually landed where my grandmother bought the home that she did. So that was not too far from Dumbo. That was in Fort Greene.
Got it. Okay. And then it was probably, I would have to look, but it was probably lower to mixed income depending on exactly where you were around that area.
Yeah, because it wasn't the Barclays Center. All these places were not developed at that time. So even when my grandmother was buying, people said, why are you buying in that area? Because it was dangerous back in the, I guess, 90s and early 2000s. But she ended up still doing it.
Well, as someone then who has kind of been on all sides of the evolution of Brooklyn, which is, you know, Brooklyn is just one place, but it is pretty emblematic of a lot of American cities in terms of what's happened since the late 80s to early 90s. Can you share a little bit about your thoughts on gentrification and kind of what it means to you, what it meant to you, you know, throughout the past 20 years or even more? I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
Yeah, you know, so I always, Brooklyn, I think in New York City, but I can speak specifically to Brooklyn because I saw it all the time is, you know, one block you have people who have a lot of money or are wealthy, and then like the other block are the projects or people who don't have a lot of money or resources. And my best friend, like she grew up in the projects, so, and I used to hang out there all the time on the other side of Brooklyn in East New York. And so I used to just see that every day. And even East New York now on the other side of Brooklyn is going through a bit of that because they have all this development and people moving deeper in to, I guess, take advantage of that. You know, I think there are a couple of things. I think the fact that people who grow up and come here to Brooklyn or raised in Brooklyn but then can't buy anything because they're priced out is, like, sad. It's a problem that, like, a lot of my friends either moved. So I was a lucky one because I took advantage of buying something early on, whereas some of my friends didn't do that, right? They were establishing themselves. They were getting their ish together. And then now, you know, they're older, but they're trying to find something in Brooklyn and they can't afford it. So I think that's problematic where it's like you can't even own a piece of property in the on the street you were born if that's what you desire. And then you might have people who come in who don't understand the culture or the block and want to change it, because they don't understand what a corner store is or why things might be happening at a certain time of night. And it's just like, this is just the vibe and the culture of the neighborhood. So I think when it can give you resources or you can have more money put towards the resources in the community, it's a good thing. So whether that's the school system or community centers or money being put back in the community or people who are moving consciously not to price other people out, that it's helpful to a certain point. But then I think for the most part, it becomes unhelpful. It becomes just this insidious way that people who have continue to have and the people who don't continue to get priced out and don't have. So, you know, speaking as someone who does own property in an area where, again, if I sold that right now, I wouldn't be able to buy a bigger property. You know, I would be priced out of that too at the moment. But it almost feels like, who am I to like say anything, because I'm participating in the system in a way, but I also feel it's my duty to do that, because I do feel a sense of pride that I do own in Dumbo and that I do own in a building like that. And so how can I then educate? And part of that is like my platform. How can I help other people if they do desire to do something like this? Maybe it's not in Brooklyn, maybe it's in Queens or in another, you know, area that's not where they grew up, unfortunately, but how can I inspire them to build wealth for themselves? And maybe not everybody can do it, but there might be a handful that can. So how do we help make sure that the right people or the people who have the community at best interest have the money to do these things and not just the people we don't want to have the money and the property?
Of which there are many, many in New York. You mentioned earlier that you don't charge what you could to your tenant. And that, you know, part of what can make gentrification so destructive is this prioritization of profit above anything else and maximizing that profit, which I think is objectively true, right? But part of that is having an internal sense of what is enough for us individually. And, you know, when we stop prioritizing just more profit and income for ourselves and we start prioritizing other things, especially in the context of aiming toward financial independence, how do you determine what is enough financially for you?
Well, there are opportunity costs and trade-offs for everything that we do. And when I was younger or I had more time, I think I was more willing to be on my long commute or to work hard. And then when I got pregnant, that was my first signal or my first prompt to say to myself with my first child that this is not okay. I don't want to be in this car for an hour and a half one way. I'm going to have a family. I'm going to expand that family. And so time and energy became more precious to me. I realized that it was very limited when I was then pressured with just responsibilities, having a kid and now this commute. So I feel like it's even more clear for me now, the older I get, now that, you know, my kids are 9, 7, and 5 starting their, you know, activities. So after this, got to go pick them up from after school and take one to practice. And so if I have an ability to make money, but it interferes with me doing the things I enjoy with them, like, you know, taking them to a practice or being able to take them on vacation, that's a stop for me. And I think it's understanding that about yourself, that it's not necessarily what you see other people doing or building. You know, I often think, oh, I can probably like build Journey to Launch to be a lot bigger than it is if I did this and did that. But I don't have the energy or capacity to do that. I don't have the drive right now, I guess, in a way, even though other people would probably say otherwise, to do it in that way. So I feel like I've just understood that more based on having constraints on my time and realizing that for me, enough is, you know, not necessarily having earning $1 million, but it's having security that if I wanted to quit Journey to Launch in a few years or even take a break, I can do that. And how much money do I need to do that? How much money do I need on our investments and our savings account? And if that's there, then for me, that's my enough point. And so the same thing with my tenant. You know, she may move out and I'm hoping she doesn't. But if she does, like, I don't want to deal with the hassle of working to find someone else and hoping that they're great. I'd rather just, if she loves it, let's work together to have you stay. And so I'm looking at what is the energy, what is the time that it's going to take me to earn more or to do this thing, and is it worth it?
So as you mentioned, you have 3 children, which for a lot of people, I think becomes an interesting inflection point. Obviously, you mentioned some of the positives, but I think, you know, especially when you look at like sociological data, it's very interesting how having children can often make people more conservative, less community oriented. Like, for example, this is like an anecdotal thing, but I think it rings true for a lot of people that I know. You know, people who prior to having children would never dream of sending their kid to a private school, you know, would never dream of moving to, you know, a very homogenous suburb or, you know, living a very specific type of lifestyle, who then once they do have children, flip on all of those issues. And these are even people, I think, who for many, they were political convictions, you know, they were social convictions beforehand. But sociologically, we really see how having children, especially in big cities, can become these kind of inflection points toward a much more individualized way of viewing the world. Individual in this case, meaning yourself and your immediate family. You are someone who has chosen to stay in New York City, who is very involved in your community, who is raising your children very close to where you grew up and is making a lot of these more kind of community-oriented choices. Can you talk a little bit about that phenomenon and kind of how you view balancing raising your children with a higher level of privilege than you experience, but not, you know, being part of the problem?
Yeah, it's so interesting. I think there are a lot of layers here. Because you mentioned the private school, and it's like, it's one of those things where when I grew up here in Brooklyn, I had a lot, even I went to public school and I had a lot of access. I went through the gifted and talented program. And so I had a great education here. And seeing my kids now, right, they go to a great public school right now, but there's like this middle school issue where we're trying to find a good middle school for my son. And they say, boys, that's like a hard middle school is where you either lose them or they, you know, they can choose a pathway. It's so impressionable. And so it is something we've been looking at. What would an independent school look like, mm-hmm. you know, for us?
Like a charter school?
No, not a charter school, like an independent private school look like. Okay. What would that look like? Is that a, you know, healthy environment for them? And I've come to realize, because I've spoken to a lot of people who've gone that route, and it's funny, I feel like the perception from the white people that have went versus the people of color that have went are different.
How so?
So, and you know what? This is a generalization, because not like I've not pulled everyone that's went. I just know.
Oh, you haven't asked
right.
millions of people.
Right, so I just want to say from my perception, you know, I know a family, like everyone went. He said he went, his wife went, they all went to the same private school. And he was like, I would never send my kids there. And this is the same one I was considering to send
this
my kids.
This is a person of color.
No, this is a white person.
White person, okay.
And he said, I would never send my kids there because the level of access and the type of money that these kids have, it's just, it takes what they do, like being kids, being teenagers, to another level of just privilege. And so I was like, that's interesting. And then the other people that I know have went to the same school or schools like that who are people of color or black, they're like, well, it's definitely not easy to be a black person in this environment, depending on especially the school you pick, but that the access and the information that you get is by far, when they compare maybe like their friends and like the education they got, is so much better. And so obviously we're not at that point where we're making a decision yet. But I find that, you know, maybe for the guy that I was speaking to, you know, for him, it was normal. Everyone around him went to that school. So it was mm-hmm. not a, for him, it's not like a, oh my gosh, I wonder what that's like. Like, he's like, I've been there, done that. Actually, I feel like I'd rather this route for my kids. And you're telling that to someone who I couldn't even imagine. I never imagined that I could even send my kids to school like that. But if it's a possibility, like, it's something I'm willing to look into instead of just like cutting it off for whatever reason. So I think privilege, we all have it. Mm-hmm. And I think even myself, I had more privilege than my mom did. I have, you know, my kids have more privilege than I do. But the reason I feel like I strived and worked so hard was because of the lack in some areas.
Yeah.
And so, like you said, like, how do you instill that in your kids? Because the whole part of the goal for me, at least as being a parent, is providing them with security,
right,
and the ability to make choices not from necessity but from things that they want to do. But I do believe that there should be a grind, there should be a work ethic put in them the way that I did. But it's hard. You have to manufacture it a bit. You have to be more thoughtful in your communication to them, in talking about the world, because maybe when I was able to do certain things with my mom, I was a latchkey kid, so I understood what that meant to come home and be home by myself, to open the door and do my homework. And my kids, they don't have that experience. So how do you instill that in them? It's something I'm still figuring out. So far, I think, you know, they're pretty young. It's okay. But the question about raising kids or the switch, I think it is true for a lot of people. I would say for me, I feel like I haven't changed my mind on a lot of things since having kids. It's still been the same, because it's always been about getting myself to a better position when I was growing up, seeing what we didn't have. And so it meant then getting good grades. It meant getting an internship. It meant getting that full-time job out of school. And then I went back to get my master's in real estate because I worked in commercial real estate. It meant when I wanted to do Journey to Launch Now, what does that look like? How would that impact my family? So I feel like I've always had this ambition to strive for more at to a certain point, but in a way where I have a diverse group of friends, and not just, black and white, but within like my black friends, a diverse kind of friends where, I have friends that grew up without much and still don't have much, and I have other friends that have a lot. And so that has shaped my opinion, and then their political or cultural differences help to inform me to be more balanced that, okay, what do I want my kids to know that they can have friends from.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Different cultures, backgrounds, income levels, and teach them to like love and connect based on, what's inside. And yeah, so it's not easy though. I'm still learning myself.
Totally. Yeah, it's really interesting. I grew up low income, have, changed social classes radically. My husband and I help family members, and we made the choice a long time ago to not have kids, but we have nieces and things like that. And one thing that is always shocking to me, because at least sociologically speaking, if you become higher income, statistically, you are going to be around more and more and more people who grew up higher income, who, it's pretty rare to change social classes in the US. It's about 12% social mobility, which is very low for a developed country. But so statistically, if you grew up low income and then become higher income, you're going to end up having people around you who grew up higher income. And for me, one thing that's always so interesting about that, even not necessarily sharing the parenthood aspect of it, because, obviously that's something I can't necessarily connect on in the same way, is seeing how much of like all of the sort of baggage and the experiences and information that you take with you growing up lower income is like completely foreign to other people. Like, I don't have a college degree, for example. Everyone I know has a college degree. Like, I didn't have a lot of these experiences that everyone I knew growing up had. And there can be, I think, like you mentioned, like this constant feeling of striving for something because you're sort of like always trying to arrive where other people were born.
Right.
I'm just interested in how you kind of approach that psychologically.
Well, and I think again, it's very layered because while I definitely am probably above, I'm definitely above the median for income, I don't really feel like it doesn't feel like I'm wealthy. Like, I feel wealthy in the sense of my time and energy, and I'm definitely privileged in the sense of that, we don't have to think much about doing things for our kids or doing certain things, right? But with that, because I am, around so people who have more and people who have less, it humbles me in a bit to realize that there's more for me to have and want to achieve if I desire to do that, but also that I'm like, it's okay to stop. So I feel like my striving, when I say that's probably where I am now, where it's like, I'm okay if I do nothing else. Like, I mean, of course, like, I want to continue to spread the message and my work, but I don't have to build a $1 million company. I don't have to have like a bunch of employees. I am happy to really follow the true path of financial independence, which is like, I really choose what I want to do once I reach that number. And, maybe I'll show up. You might say, hey, do you want to like do this interview? And I'm like, I'm taking a year off, and that be the case. And so I definitely connect with your point. I think for me, because I still am around people who have various levels of income or education. So when you talked about like the college degree, it's like knowing people who are incarcerated or certain like stories that like would be, if I said some of the stories like of the people that I know in real life, they'd be like, really? But it's like, that's for some of my circle of friends, that's normal. And so I feel like I've been able to move around in those circles and stay true to myself. And maybe part of that is like having friends since I was 6 years old and 12 years old. And so before the money or before Journey to Launch, it's like they knew Jamila and I knew them. And this is the house I used to go to after school. And so, and we're still friends today. And that hasn't changed anything, what I've done or what they've done. And for me, that's important to keep, which is why for my kids, it's like I want them to have a difference of friend groups. And it's not just about money. It's deeper than that. And that I don't think necessarily you can always, you can't plan for, but you can put them in environments where they can hopefully meet different people to experience that through maybe activities.
Totally. Yeah. I should be clear. I obviously have a lot of lower income people in my life. Again, when you come from that background, it's impossible to not. But I should probably be more clear that what I mean is more professionally, especially, you know, socially as you move through the professional space. Like, I can say without a doubt that I think almost literally never have worked with someone who doesn't have a college degree, outside of, you know, maybe one or two people. And even, you know, again, like you were mentioning, you went to a gifted and talented, I went to a magnet school. Mm-hmm. So even being lower income, I had a radically different experience than all of the kids in my neighborhood. Like all the other kids in my neighborhood growing up, like they already, like even all the kids that went to my magnet school, most of them went to a college at the end of it, which is so rare for, and I think a lot of people don't realize, like even for example, things that, you know, once you move in a different circle socially can be taken so for granted, like for example, traveling internationally. Only 30% of Americans have a passport. Like where I grew up, it was no one, what? Like you're not going internationally, what are you talking about? Unless like literally the only people who did were like immigrants essentially, who would like occasionally go back to see family. But the idea of traveling internationally was totally rare. But you know, I think you mentioned that you don't feel rich.
Money wise in terms, yes, but I'll let you finish.
Well, because like for me, what's so interesting is I feel insanely rich, like especially compared to, you know, again, not, it totally varies. But like when I look at my life, I feel every day like, holy shit, like this is a level of privilege that like is unimaginable to me. And you mentioned that do you think it's because you have people around you who have so much more than you do?
No. So I think everyone's going to define what their enough point is or what their financial independence number is or what rich feels like to them. So I think there's layers to being rich. And so when I said it, I meant more like money rich. Like I'm rich in like when it comes to family and like friends and like security, like that's, but when it comes to me, maybe, I don't know. I'm really literally talking about just inflow of money and like what we can do with it. Like we're privileged to be able to like take our kids to Disney and not worry too much about that. But there's probably that part of me from a childhood, and that has helped me save and invest and do some of the things I've done with my money, still feel like that's still not a lot. Like that's still, you know, there's a, you know, maybe a fear of losing it, which I talk about in the book, where, you know, we can build all the assets we want and invest and have money, and that's good, and it provides a level of security. But at a certain point, you know, all that can be taken away from us. Or, you know, the markets can crash. You know, if you look at your account every day, it goes up and goes down. And so...
Well, that's why I don't do it.
Well, I don't look at my account every day either. But it's because, you know, I found my worthiness outside of money.
Yeah.
And so I think rich and feeling like I have or don't have money, it's not from a place of, oh, like, I can pay my bills. Mm-hmm. But from the outside looking in, maybe someone looking at me from a materialistic level would be like, well, she doesn't like drive a nice car, or she doesn't like look, you know, a certain way in terms of spending on money on certain things. But that's not where I value to spend money. And so, and to be clear too, it's not like I know that many like people who have a lot of money. If I do, it's through professional settings.
Right.
It's not like in my real life, I have friends that have like a ton of money. I don't like have friends like that yet. But yeah, I don't know. I just feel like the definition of rich is going to be different and being financially free, it's going to feel and look different for everyone. And that's everyone's job, I guess, to decide what that looks like for them.
Well, speaking of, you know, going back to the kind of concept of changing social classes, which I think is a really understudied phenomenon psychologically and socially, because there's just so many things that it impacts. And one of the things that I personally experienced, but also we hear constantly from our audience, especially people who are first gen or immigrants themselves, is balancing helping other people in your family with helping yourself. It's definitely something that my husband and I navigate. And, you know, I've heard all kinds of answers from different people on how they navigate it. I would really love to hear yours, especially as someone who I assume you still have family back in Jamaica as well as here in New York. How do you navigate that?
Yeah. So I have a lot of siblings from my dad and one sibling from my mom. So I have, you know, a very wide like family, and they're mostly in Jamaica and a few here. And when I was younger, so before I had kids, I helped a lot more with my family or my siblings because they were younger and they were in school. And I knew that they didn't have like the privilege I had because I was the only one. Me and one other sister from my father had papers or were here. Got the rest of them were in Jamaica. So they didn't have the same access and resources that I did. So when I got older, and, you know, I knew they were in school, it was like, okay, if you need books or anything, I will help you do that. So did that more when I was in my 20s. Now all my siblings, for the most part, they're grown with kids and their own families and self-sustaining for the most part. You know, I adopt the attitude of put your own, you know, save yourself first before you save others. And it's okay to be selfish. Now, I understand, though, like culturally and for some people, that is like a hard line to draw, that it's just not okay, you don't do that, you know, you can't sleep at night if you were to think that way. And for me, I've been okay with drawing a line, and you know, no one in my family asks me for money anymore. I think they just all know that they would have to really like, what is it for? Like, I'm more of teaching them to fish than giving them the fish. So I will help you if information wise. I will spend time to get you the resources and to give you a little head start if you need money. But it's not going to be just like, I just need it just because I need it. And I'm like, yeah, and I have three kids and, you know, they need this. So for me, I think they know that about my personality, and I'm very direct and straight with them. And so I'm able to do that, and they respect me. And, you know, and so I haven't had to do that. And I know, like, for my mom, for example, and other people, like, if we do need to help other people, like, we will. But it's not something that is baked into my budget. But I know a lot of people where that they have to include that because it is just part of their culture. It's part of what they're supposed to do, which I don't think is a bad thing.
No, so, neither do I. I mean, for my husband and I, especially, part of our choice not to have children is, you know, that does free up a lot of budget to help other people. You know, like, we can help send other people in our families to college and help do these other things because, you know, I think part of what is, and you know, it's not it, like, I should be clear, like, no one's out here like banging down our door. Yeah. Like, it is a choice. But I think on the flip side, like, it's one thing if it's a proactive choice and it's something you really want to do, or it's something that is out of, you know, real necessity and there aren't any other options and all of these things. But something that I think happens a lot that people tend to underestimate is when people sabotage their own financial safety to help, let's say, a previous generation, like, all you're really accomplishing longer term is creating a cycle where someone is going to have to do that for you. And you're putting yourself in a position where, you know, I think for a lot of people, one of the biggest disparities I think that we don't talk about enough is the disparity of people who stand to inherit from aging or, you know, passing away parents and people who are inheriting a huge burden financially, who will have to care for them in older age, who will have to perhaps even physically themselves care for them, who will, you know, be left with burdens and debts and all of these things. And I think it surprises me that more people who are really lucid about so many financial issues don't see the vicious cycle necessarily when they're so involved.
Right. And where that's the sandwich generation, right? Where you have kids and you have older people in your life you have to take care of. So you are feeling it from both the top and bottom, right? You being in the middle of the sandwich. I just think it's so one of the things when people ask me like, oh, should I, you know, how can I invest for my children or do this for my children? And, you know, I'm like, are you investing for yourself?
Right.
Like, well, are you okay? Because the greatest gift financially you can give them is that they don't have to worry about you or as much when you get older. So like, for example, my mom, she's pretty self-sustaining and self-sufficient. So is my grandmother, where they have like enough to take care of themselves. Like, especially my grandmother's not working anymore, but she's okay. My mom, eventually she's going to retire in a couple of years. She'll be okay based on her pension and her investments. That for me is like, that's the greatest financial gift she could have ever given me. Even more than the condo, right? Like the fact that I can now, the money that I receive from my family, I can, as a family of five, we can sustain ourselves in, you know, New York. So I always say like, I know you want to help your kids. I get it. I'm a mom. You know, you want to do certain things for them. But really, you need to make sure you're okay first. That should be honestly the last thing outside of or after you make sure financially you're okay.
I totally agree. Well, on that note, I mean, you know, you mentioned earlier the disparity between the people who might go to these more elite schools, you know, the experience of being around so many kids with so much privilege and what that can do. And you mentioned how, you know, there's a real delicate balance between wanting your children to have this wonderful life and also not wanting to like ruin any chance of like them having that, you know, that grind and that integrity and that sense of connection to, you know, work ethic and values and things like that. Like, can you talk a little bit about the ways that you navigate that in practice and kind of what you see going on around you as you're in this like radically changing community?
Yeah. So, you know, we don't live, so where we settled is deeper into Brooklyn. So it's not as diverse, you know, and for us, they're actually growing up in a way where, yeah, they're not on public transportation as much as I was. They're not latchkey kids. Like, someone goes to get them even after school. Like, you know, so they're in after school now, mm-hmm. which is so helpful for me because school ends at 2:20 and I'm like, how am I supposed to get anything done, you know, in the day if I have
that
to pick them up?
That is so crazy to me. We can talk about that. Right. But how does that even work?
No, so it's a lot of, you know, kids are in after school. They have grandparents or people picking them up because, you know, parents are working. And so I just feel like, I felt so bad about having them go to after school and not picking them up directly because I'm like, right. What if they're hungry? You know, like they don't really eat a lot of lunch at school. And then some of my friends and other parents were just like, they'll be okay. And then I thought about like my mom, like I used to get picked up the last like 6 or 7 p.m. because she had to work. And so, and dropped off the first, like I'd be out of the house at 6 a.m. I wouldn't see my home again until 6, 7 in certain parts of my school life. And that, you know, if their little struggle is that they have to wait a couple hours before I get them, that's, and it's relative, right? Like for me, that'd have been nothing when I was their age to get picked up at 3 instead of 2:20, not a big deal. But for them, it's like also letting them not be so comfortable all the time. Sports is a big thing, like in our family, because my husband was an athlete, is an athlete. I'm pretty athletic. I didn't play professionally or in high school, but, one thing that we realized is like having them start something like basketball is their thing now, the boys, our older two, and strive through that. And it's hard and that they, you know, things don't always go their way. And it's about the amount of work they put into it, not necessarily the results or how well they do at a game, but how well their effort is. Like we've seen improvements in like their attitude about what it takes for hard work, right? So I think there are ways to create situations where you allow them to grow into or see like this is going to take work. You can't just expect to be a great player. You have to put in work and time and effort into doing that and like showing them that. And then also just not giving in to everything. Mm-hmm. So the ice cream truck, you know, when it's nice outside, stops outside the school every day. I'm like, we're not getting it today. Like we're not like you're lucky. I even like do it the couple times I do it a month. I was like, do you know how much? And so teaching them lessons about money, because money is so, it's digital. Everything is so instant for kids. It's invisible. It's like, why not just order it? You know, they're already saying things like that to me. I'm like, because I don't want to. I value this and I want to be able to do this with my money instead. But showing them like the price for that ice cream is $4. They're selling ice cream cones for $4 now. And if I bought that for you every day, all three of you, do you know how much money that is? And I was like, do you know how much if we go to Costco and get it, and how much if you really want to like make some money, do it? And so talking through things like that with them, allowing them to see relatively like how much things cost It's not just like, you know, money appears and that we don't have to work hard for it. But then the fine line of I don't want to introduce a, you know, struggle mindset or a scarcity mindset, but I want them to understand the value of things. And so it's like little lessons like that that we've been consciously trying to do. Like, we have the money to do it, but I'm not going to buy it. I'm not going to do it because it's not something we value right now.
Well, so speaking of children, though, I mean, I feel like part of the reason that I feel as affluent as I do, although, I mean, technically, obviously, if you look at the data, yes, I'm affluent. But the bigger thing is I don't have children, which is such an expense on so many levels. We have some employees here at TFD who have children. And when they talk about the numbers for what daycare costs and, you know, what they're looking at, you know, for schools, like, tens of thousands of dollars a year, like getting up damn near 50 grand a year for a kid, which to me, I mean, I'm sure part of that is New York City and the surrounding areas, right? It's one of the most expensive markets in the country and the world. But I remember, like, when I was in high school, we had moved to a more affluent area, nowhere near New York, I'm sure, but the really crazy expensive Montessori school that, like, only the richest people went to was like $27,000 a year. And, like, you know, it was earlier, it was inflation, whatever. It's probably in the 30s now. Point being, that was considered astronomical. And it is astronomical. Yeah. But in New York, those are not astronomical numbers for daycare and things like that. How the hell are people affording to have kids in New York? What the hell?
So, right. Speaking as someone who has three of them, that's why family, okay, so I will say our economic privilege is based a lot on our social privilege in terms of having connections and family. And I think that network, right, when you don't have outward money or assets, like, you have to leverage and utilize and connect with the things that don't necessarily always cost money, which is your relationships. And so for me, the reason why, especially for the kids for the first 3 years, we were able to do it, because I was working full time up until my third child. I quit right after I gave birth or after maternity leave. And the reason why I was able to, we were doing what we were doing, was I had an aunt who helped with the kids.
Right.
And but the place we bought, it had we had like an apartment, like in the basement. So it had a separate entrance, kitchen. It was her own like living area. So similar to, I don't know, I guess, like, paying her. So we paid her to, like, I guess, nanny or babysit our kids while I worked and went to work. Because I would leave the house. My commute was, like, an hour and a half. My husband also worked, and he left early. We'd be gone from, like, 7 to 5, like, when we were in the first two kids. And so the only reason that worked was because of my aunt, where it's, like, she was helping us. Now, she actually, that's what she did for a living. So she, again, like many older Caribbean people who don't have their education, they tend to either clean houses or they can watch kids. And so we have a lot of that in our family. And it just so happened that the timing where she was between jobs and, like, now she can, like, work with her niece to help, like, with kids that she actually, I guess, wants to be around, like, it was perfect. Now, if we didn't have her, we would have spent a lot more money on childcare, but we were able to subsidize it because she had, like, her own place. And then, you know, you paid her additionally on top of that, but not like if we had to send her out or the time or energy. So going back to community, like, the big part and the way I see other people managing is because they're leaning on people in their family, right, to help watch the kids, or and because that's the biggest thing. It's a childcare when both parents are working. Even with me, I work from home, but it's like sometimes it's like, oh, you know, you can be the one that's the main parent because you're home. I'm like, I'm actually, like, working. So it's hard, right, to do that. And so I still need, I mean, they're in school. That's a help because I at least have a couple hours to get things done. But it's not easy. When it comes to money, again, there was a privilege in setting up and doing the right things in my 20s. So that when I had kids, it was later. You know, I had my first kid at 31, which, if I started earlier, we wouldn't be in the position that we are in now with them, because we would have been working on our careers. Like, but by the time we had them, we were already established. I already started on, or this journey of financial freedom that I embarked upon really was made possible because I had the career that I had.
Right.
And got my degree before I had them. You know, we waited until we got married. Though there were a lot of things that we kind of did in the right steps, so that when we're in our 30s now, we know we are a little older, we could support them and be able to pay for things.
That is still, so what I totally, what you're saying totally resonates. My sister's about to have her third kid soon. And if my parents weren't around to just provide limitless free childcare, she just wouldn't have as many kids. Like, I don't know how that would even be possible.
Yeah.
But that being said, like, my mom was a public school teacher in New York City. And, you know, I know what she made. And, like, how could any teacher have a child in this city unless they have, like, yeah, like you said, just, yeah, like, limitless free resources. Right. I mean, not, we're subsidized. Yeah.
Well, my husband is a teacher. And so, but he also, you know, he went to school. He ended up getting his master's. So he's probably at the top level of what teachers can earn based on his tenure and his degree. And so I just think we made good decisions before we knew that they were good decisions. It was like the, just the next step. So again, a lot of that was luck, some of it privilege, and a lot of hard work that we both put in to, like, put ourselves in the position. But, like, you're totally right about the teacher's thing, because that's after, because he's been working in the school system for, what's it now, like, almost 18 years, you know? Like, so there's a level that he's worked up to versus maybe someone just starting, and then where are they living? How far do they have to commute to get to the school? It's not easy.
No, my mom has been a public school teacher in several different counties, and to be fair, New York paid the best, I think, of any of those counties. But, like, she moved back to, they live in they're in South Carolina, or sorry, North, technically on the border of North Carolina, but the teachers are paid so little there that it's, I mean, we just recently had a teacher on the show who had to quit teaching. She was teaching in North Carolina because the wages were unlivable. Literally couldn't, and she didn't have kids, and she couldn't even afford to, you know, keep a roof over her head on those wages. So I really do, you know, it does, going back to the gentrification question, it's like, it seems almost impossible the way things are going, especially with property values and developments and these, you know, I mean, what is it, like 50, I think it's like 50% of the luxury housing stock in New York City is empty most of the year. It's some crazy number.
And so also the affordable, you know, all the lotteries that they have. Mm-hmm. So one of my friends, she lives in a nice neighborhood, but she lived and got it through the lottery. And now, you know, like, we have other friends who are, like, you know, they're trying to get their own place for the first time, or just maybe family members. And the threshold to be able to afford, you know, they want you to be low income. It's, like, impossible. Like, you can only basically afford this affordable house on a family of three, and you have to make, like, $10,000. It's a ridiculous number where they maybe are making $30,000, but for a family of three, that's not a lot of money. And they still don't earn enough or less or the minimum amount to get help. And I think this is where a lot of people are faced with, then why am I striving? If I can't make it to the top, the middle is nowhere to be, because then the resource, I don't qualify for the resources. So I might either stay in the bottom so I can qualify for the resources, or I have to strive really hard to, like, break through the barrier of the middle. Because when we were seeing the income thresholds, I'm like, so basically they want you to, like, quit your job so you can afford to, like, get this affordable apartment where your current income does not even help you get the basics now. Like, it was crazy what the threshold levels are for the affordable housing that they have here.
Well, I mean, that speaks to the bigger issue, which is just that, like, to live a normal middle class, quote unquote, lifestyle that we saw growing up on TV, you have to be rich.
Right.
Basically.
So my mom, right, like, she always said that, you know, you can, average is fine. Like, you know, you'll be okay, but you'll just always be struggling. And I just feel like for me, that the striving part for me was I didn't want to be in the middle. I think the only things that I could point to from my experience have been, I call it hyperlinks in the book, you know, clicking on life's hyperlinks, is that you're right. Things are hard. Life is not fair. People suck. There's a lot of things in this world, you know, we put our finger on anywhere in the world on the map, and there's some, like, tragedy and, like, just unspeakable things happening, you know, at any moment to cultures and people. And so I just feel like, yes, if we focus on that, then why, like, what's the point? I would not get out of bed. I would not want to do anything. And for me, it's always been, what do I want my life to look like? How can I change my world from my position? There's some things that we cannot change. It's a structural thing. And then there's some things, like, we personally can change. So if I'm interested in owning something, let's say I didn't have anything right now, you know, I'd be seeking out these resources. Like, okay, let me see what community resources there are. Let me go to the local library or to the local community board. Maybe there's something I don't know about. Let me talk to the other owners or people on the block that I might want to one day own. I used to walk in Bed-Stuy in Fort Greene, like when I was in my 20s, and I thought I wanted to buy a brownstone. And, you know, I would try to talk to some of the people who owned it. Like, okay, I just want to know, like, I'm not trying to like buy your house, I can't afford it, but how did you get it? And a lot of it was like, oh, my grandmother like left it for me. And so I was just very inquisitive. So I think clicking on hyperlinks means, you know, when you read an article, there's like a highlighted word, and sometimes you click on it because it takes you deeper into something else. And I think there are a lot of hyperlinks that lead to nothing and are pointless, but there are a lot of hyperlinks that we might just gloss over that could potentially be something. And so to continue to click on those hyperlinks, be inquisitive, and to ask questions, because most of the things that I've learned about that have helped me was through information, like Googling something and then finding like this article or the name of this book, picking it up, reading it, and then it referenced something else. Oh, I didn't know there was like a grant, or I didn't know podcasts exist and that people were talking about financial independence, and it kept going down the pathway. And some of them are direct. I'm not saying you're going to own a home just by like listening to a podcast, but you never know through meeting people or listening to the resources they use what could benefit you. And that has been helpful to me on my journey, is that, okay, where do you want to own something? Maybe it's not New York right now. Maybe it's another area. Do you know other people in those areas or people who are investing outside of New York? What does that look like? What is plausible for you? Not that nothing is plausible, so what's the point? But what can I do? What can I do differently if I try to do something?
Well, so, you know, as we've discussed, you have your first book coming out on December 5th, which is obviously a huge milestone for your work and for your brand. In terms of what comes after, are you planning to take a big break? Are you planning to, like, what's on the horizon?
I don't know. I really don't know. I knew I should have planned something. Everyone says you should, like, plan time off.
I think so.
Especially because of the time of year, like yeah. Right before Christmas.
You should be taking time off
regardless. Right. I know. So I don't know. I honestly don't have anything planned. I'd like to say like on the cusp of, you know, things can be really quiet and crickets after the book comes out, or things can like pick up and be exciting. And I'm open to either one because I've done like the work already. Mm-hmm. So I've done the work. It's here, you know, yes, I need to promote it and get it into as many hands as possible. But after that, it's kind of like you do what, you know, the reader, the journeyer does with it, what they wish to do with it. And so we'll see. But I do need to plan a book moon. I think someone called it that, where you like just take off and turn off the computer and social media.
Wonderful. And as a last question about that book, I mean, if there is sort of like one really key piece of information you would want people to take from your work, and it could be directly from the book or it could be more generally, what would you say is like the number one thing?
I'd say that the journey to financial independence, and the way that I speak about it, to having enough money where you never have to work again actively because you can live off of your investments, is a very audacious, privileged goal to set. I know that, I understand it, but based on my experience and so many people that I've interviewed that have reached it at varying levels, that the journey to financial independence is not necessarily just like an outward one and reaching this far off goal, but who you become on the journey. And so I'm not completely financially independent yet. I mean, if we lowered our expenses, we could be, but I don't want to. But I've achieved more freedom than I ever thought was possible when I was in that commute, in that cubicle. And it was all for striving for this audacious goal. It's like the moonshot goal. You shoot for the moon, and if you fail, you end up among the stars. And that's why I think everyone should be on the journey to financial independence, not because of the number, more because of who you become and the progress you'll make externally, but mostly internally because of who you need to become on the journey.
Beautifully put. Well, thank you so much for being here. And everyone, please, please go pick up Jamila's new book and listen to her wonderful, wonderful podcast. And thank you all so much for being here. And we will see you back here next Monday on an all-new episode of The Financial Confessions. Bye.